in Racine, 40 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. If you're even a casual fan of professional baseball, then you're surely aware that the 2022 World Series between the Philadelphia Phillies and Houston Astros opens tonight. I wish I could say that it was due to my careful planning, but it's really just dumb luck or divine providence that part one of today's program deals with the World Series, and specifically the fascinating history of the World Series, which dates back to more than a century. That's part one of today's program. In part two, we'll take a look at some of the most significant and consequential injuries in professional sports history. Here's part one. And I'm really delighted to be able to talk baseball for the next few minutes with Tyler Kepner, who covers baseball for the New York Times and is the author of a best-selling book called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. For the New York Times, Tyler Kepner has covered every game of every World Series for the past two decades. And that sets the stage for his newest book, which is called The Grandest Stage, A History of the World Series, in which Tyler Kepner takes a comprehensive look at the World Series as it has played out more than 100 times, dating all the way back to 1903, examining some of the most dramatic finishes in World Series history, some of the most lopsided histories, and a lot of the great players who have figured prominently in World Series history, including some who have faltered in crucial moments and others who rose to the occasion in tremendously impressive fashion. And he really helps us think about why it is that certain players seem destined to excel, to achieve their highest excellence on this greatest of all stages. The book is published by Doubleday. Again, it's titled The Grandest Stage, A History of the World Series. And Tyler Kepner, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm really happy to be talking with you. A couple of quick overall questions about you and your career. First of all, do you come at this as somebody who once upon a time was a baseball player out there on the field? Or do you come at your love of baseball from the first as a fan in the stands?
Oh, well, I mean, I've always been a fan. I mean, I played, sure. I played through high school, Little League, and middle school and summer leagues in high school, and still get out there for an occasional media game with when the New York guys face the Boston guys at Fenway once a year. That's about it for me playing wise. It's just I'm a fan. I always will be a fan.
And clearly, the idea of writing about sports and specifically writing about baseball held great attraction for you from a very early age.
It really did, yeah. I mean, I was looking for, I guess, a way to maybe be involved in baseball as a career. And at a very early age, I was lucky enough to grow up outside Philadelphia and be around some great sports writing, particularly Jason Stark who was with the Philadelphia Inquirer now, and he's gone on to a Hall of Fame career. And really just seeing how much fun he seemed to have covering baseball. I thought, I did pretty well in my writing classes at school, so I'm like, well, maybe I can try this. But love baseball. Why don't I try writing about baseball? And here I am still doing it.
Very good. I know in your career with the New York Times that you started out a couple of years covering the Mets, and then from there, 8 years covering the Yankees, and then ultimately your beat, as it were, expanded to encompass essentially all of baseball. What was it like to switch from the Mets to the Yankees? I mean, did that feel essentially like the same gig, the same beat, with just the details being different, or did that feel really different?
It was mostly the same gig without the with the details being a little different. I mean, I had switched before because I started out, I covered the Angels for a year out west, and then the Seattle Mariners for like a year and a half. So I had switched teams before, and the Yankees obviously have the most expectations and history and the biggest stars, but by that point I had covered Ken Griffey Jr. and Alex Rodriguez and Mike Piazza and some other big guys. So I felt like it would be a natural transition, and it was interesting because they were coming off four straight years in the World Series, a three-peat, and then when they came up just short against Arizona, and I thought, well, one of these years the law of averages is going to be that they'll stop making the World Series every year. And sure enough, I covered 8 years, and they only made it twice. But I guess I was lucky because it's been 13 years since then, and they haven't made it back.
Huh. So one of the intriguing things you explore in your book is the centrality of the World Series, that it is something that just about all of us have some acquaintance with, even if some of us don't follow it as with the same ferocious interest as others. I think at one point in your book you write, to be an American was to have at least a passing familiarity with the World Series. Of course, in recent years, the World Series, at least in some respects, has been supplanted by the Super Bowl, the ultimate championship game of professional football in America. Give us your take on the comparison between those two high-profile games or series of games, of course, when it comes to the World Series, and what you see is there, in a sense, comparative worth.
Yeah, I love the Super Bowl as well. I don't mean to knock it. It's a great event, but it's one day. It's one day, sort of more of a national holiday in a way, because people it's on TV at a time when it's the perfect time, really. It's like 6:30 Eastern, 3:30 Pacific, so everybody can kind of enjoy it and have a party and bet on things and get all excited about the commercials. There's so much more to it than just a game. And I think the World Series is, it's a little different because, well, it's very different. I mean, it starts later. It starts at 8:30 Eastern, and it's up to four to seven games rather than just one. So it's more like a week plus that you live rather than one big day that you prepared for, which is sort of like baseball itself, right? I mean, football gets everybody. Most people say football is their favorite sport, but when you get down to it, you really only watch one game a week, maybe two if you watch a couple other games, but you watch your team once a week. Baseball, you watch your team every day, so it's a fundamentally different experience, and I think the World Series reflects that because it's a series of games that you can get really involved in and interested in and think about every day for a week or so.
We're speaking with Tyler Koeppner from the New York Times about his newest book called The Grandest Stage, A History of the World Series. So tell us, first of all, what prompted you to want to undertake an assignment like studying and writing about 117 World Series dating all the way back to 1903. It just seems like a monumental undertaking, even for somebody who loves the game of baseball as much as you did. Did anything in particular prompt you to want to do this, to take this amount of time and energy to research this and put this book together?
I guess after doing the first book about the history of pitching, this one felt a little more manageable, actually, because, when you talk about a history of pitching, you're talking about the entire history of baseball, so even earlier than than just the World Series era, which started in 1903. There have been 10,000 pitchers or so, in baseball history. So not that I had talked to all of them, but I felt like that was even a wider history to explore. With 117 distinct events, yeah, that's a lot. But I wasn't going to do it as a chronology, so I didn't feel like, oh, well, now I got to dig into the 33 World Series. Now I got to dig into the 34 World Series and 35 and so on. Like, I was able to sort of pick and choose where to find the best moments that reflected the themes that I explored. So I had, seven different chapters and themes. And I was able to look at, okay, what are the consequential managerial moves, or what are some teams that really reflect the way World Series teams are built? What are some unsung heroes? Who are some unsung heroes? How do guys deal with pressure? So by breaking it down into themes rather than just, a sort of compulsory look at every single series, I think that was more manageable for me.
I think it's a beautiful way to craft the book, to frame it, and I think you've done a wonderful job. I am assuming that because the World Series, at least for most of this long history, has been such a high-profile event, there is no shortage of information readily available. But how about when we're going all the way back to 1903 and that first World Series between the Boston Americans and I think the Pittsburgh Pirates? Even then, in its very first years, was this a big enough deal that lots of people were writing and their writing was preserved? I assume you had no trouble uncovering the most essential information.
That's right, yeah. It was pretty big right from the start. Baseball had already kind of grabbed hold of American attention, and this was the big, the big contest between the two big leagues, and so certainly the Boston Globe archives were readily available, and others. There have been books written about that first World Series specifically, so that one wasn't so hard to find out about. The fun part of that one was actually doing some exploring at the campus of Northeastern University, where the Huntington Avenue grounds used to be, and finding the exact spot of home plate and the pitcher's mound. They have a statue of Cy Young kind of tucked into a grove of trees there, and most of the kids just pass by it pretty oblivious, but if they look around, they'll see a little plaque that this is where the first pitch of the first World Series took place. So that's kind of cool, just nestled right in there on the college campus in Boston.
One of the points that seems to be of particular fascination to you is something I touched on in the introduction, namely how certain players seem to just thrive, flourish in the sort of special, uncompromising spotlight of the World Series, while other great players, it seems, sort of faltered or wilted for one reason or another. Let's talk first about those that experienced, for the most part, disappointment in the World Series. Give us one or two examples that you think are especially notable.
Well, one I think of from my own experience as a kid. Like, the first World Series I went to was in 1983. I was 8 years old, and Mike Schmidt was the big star for the Phillies. That was my team, and he was 1-for-20 in that World Series. He was really not himself at all. He had a broken bat single. He was the guy who had hit the most home runs of his era, and over 500 in his career. And he just he looked helpless at the plate. And it wasn't even like he was hitting line drives or coming close to home runs. It was just it was almost sad to watch. And yet I knew that 3 years earlier he was the MVP of the Phillies World Series in 80. So talking to Mike Schmidt about it was really illuminating, because he talked about how he allowed himself to get consumed by the pressure, and not just being willing to take a little single to right field or a walk in a big spot, trying to force the issue. And, you know, this is a guy who had had it all going on a couple of years earlier, but he still was vulnerable to, you know, that mentality that can sink you in the big spot. So it just sort of shows you that even the best can fail whenever he's watching.
As you're describing that, it occurs to me that it seems like baseball is a sport in which that really can happen and does happen fairly often. And not that there aren't plenty of instances in, for instance, football or basketball or wherever, where a player feels incredible pressure and pushes themselves in a way that ultimately undercuts their performance. But it seems like in baseball, where, although it is, of course, a team out there, in so many ways it feels like a more individual sport. And the psychological element seems to be especially prominent in the game. And it makes sense then that would really come to bear when the stakes are so high, as in, for instance, the World Series.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart observation, Greg. I mean, like, you know, you have the one-on-one confrontation, which is how every play begins, pitcher and the catcher, or, you know, pitcher throwing the catcher and the batter trying to hit it. And so, you know, the spotlight really is on you and on that matchup, that one-on-one matchup within a team game. And it's built on failure. We always hear that. 300 hitters is, of course, you know, they only get hit 3 out of 10 times, 10 at bats. So, you know, and even if you throw in walks, you know, you have a 400 on base percentage, that's awesome, but it still means you're 6 times out of 10, you're not getting on base. So you have to learn how to deal with failure to begin with to succeed at baseball. And, you know, when it's in a World Series and you're the last team standing, there's nobody else to look for, no other distractions. Every game is magnified, and it really heightens the heat of that one-on-one confrontation.
And your book certainly does a wonderful job of telling the story of, for instance, that sad moment in 1986 when Bill Buckner let that baseball just pass right between his legs. And even though I'm someone who's not followed baseball all that carefully, just by strange accident, I was watching that game and saw that happen. And and you tell more obscure stories as well, like that of Dodgers catcher Mickey Owen, who flubbed at an important moment in 1941. And I think essentially the series was lost right then and there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he, you know, it was one of those subtle things. Like, it was two outs and two strikes. And the Dodgers were about to tie the series against the mighty Yankees, and Mickey Owen called for a breaking ball, but didn't really specify which type of breaking ball. And, you know, he was expecting a big looper, and instead it was more of a slider, and it got past him. And you know, that dropped third strike or missed third strike gave the Yankees another life, and up comes Joe DiMaggio, and he gets the big hit, and the Dodgers were foiled, and it really stayed that way. I mean, that was 41, and the Dodgers lost to the Yankees continually. You know, they lost to them in 47 and 49 and 52 and 53 and 56, but they did win it that one time in 55. So Brooklyn got one championship before the Dodgers headed west.
Well, I appreciate not only how you tell the story of these moments or these stories of disappointment, but also the story of how these players dealt with that. I mean, lived with maybe incredibly important pain and disappointment and regret about how they maybe failed to rise to the occasion. On the other hand, your book is also full of amazing stories of incredible athletes, just like Mr. October Reggie Jackson. Quickly tell us why he stands as an exceptional success story in the grand story of World Series baseball.
Well, he's got the nickname Mr. October, and he earned it. Yeah, he was MVP of the first one he played in 73 for Oakland, and then when he went to the Yankees, he went there with a mandate to continue winning, and he did. You know, when you do it, when you win championships in 72, 73, 74, 77, 78, and you hit so many home runs, 3 in one game, he really just personified kind of, you know, how to be the best version of yourself in the World Series. He's got 5 rings to prove it.
And you go on to tell all kinds of other great success stories, including those by players that most of us have never, ever heard of, and all kinds of other really interesting information here. At one point in the book, I think really early on, you say that this book is a history, not the history of the World Series. Explain what that distinction means to you.
Well, just that I think the history would have to be something where you have a lot of statistical tables where you show precisely how everybody hit, pitched in every series, and all the results. And that's all out there available in online and in the record books. But this is more the stories that I found interesting and that I could uncover. And if someone else wanted to do a book like this, they would have maybe a different perspective and be drawn to different things than I was. But this is meant to be written by someone, who with my perspective and the people I could talk to. So hopefully I did justice to the event and, show it to the reader in a way that he or she will get the full picture of the series, but, maybe learn a few new things along the way.
Absolutely. I think you've done a wonderful job. And the book, again, is titled The Grandest Stage, A History of the World Series, published by Doubleday, and the author from the New York Times, Tyler Koeppner. Tyler Koeppner, congrats on a terrific book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was really fun to talk to you. Best wishes to you.
All right. Good job. Thanks, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from the Morning Show archives. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about some very intriguing stories out of the world of sports, and in particular, the way in which sometimes various injuries and other health mishaps can lead to unintended consequences. That is at least part of the through line of a really engrossing book called Tiger Woods' Back and Tommy John's Elbow, Injuries and Tragedies That Transformed Careers, Sports, and Society. This is a book written by Dr. Jonathan Gelber, who is an orthopedic surgeon and who has worked for a great deal in the realm of sports medicine and has written extensively on the topic. His book is just endlessly fascinating as it explores some myths and some misunderstandings that have surrounded some very, very familiar stories in the sports world. And I'm really appreciative of Dr. Gelber making time in his busy schedule to talk about his book again, titled Tiger Woods' Back and Tommy John's Elbow. Dr. Jonathan Gelber, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the kind words.
It's a great book. It really, really is. Explain to our listeners why your book begins with, of all things, cobras in the nation of India.
Yeah, so the book begins with the chapter on the cobra effect, which really sets the stage for the theme of the book. And briefly, the cobra effect revolves around a story in Imperial India where there was a large venomous snake population, specifically cobras, which were causing problems in the villages. And the government officials came up with a plan to combat the problem. They would put a bounty on snake skins. So the more snake skins you brought, the more money you could make, and sounded like a win-win situation for everybody involved. So the villagers began to bring in snake skins by the basket load, and the bounties were going out, but the population of snakes did not go down. So an investigation took place, and it was found that the farmers were actually raising these cobras just to kill and skin for the bounties. So once the government officials found out about this, they canceled the bounty program. So the farmers who had raised all these snakes had nothing left to do with these snakes. There's no market to sell them. So they released them back into the wild. And so then, in essence, the snake population rose. So while we had a well-intentioned idea to solve a problem, that being the bounty program, it actually backfired and ended up causing a worsening of the problem. And that's really the theme of this book. Each chapter focuses on an athlete, but the story is really, where did our intentions go wrong? And oftentimes they ended up with the opposite than intended consequence.
Right. And we should mention, too, that your book not only has these interesting stories out of the world of sports, but most of the chapters begin with another example of the so-called Cobra effect that have nothing to do with the world of sports, but just another example of how our best intentions can sometimes lead to a given problem being, in fact, worsened rather than improved. And I appreciate that that theme as it runs through the book. And probably there is no better example of this so-called Cobra effect than what you explore in the first chapter of the book, namely the story of Tommy John, the well-known pitcher who, of course, probably best known for the surgery that was named after him. Briefly describe what went wrong with the arm of Tommy John, a mishap or a problem which was probably what also felled the great Sandy Koufax a few years earlier than that.
Yeah, the story certainly does begin with Sandy Koufax being on the Dodgers and suffering from elbow injuries. And in fact, the team physician that took care of Sandy, his partner took care of Sandy at the end of his career, and then Tommy John once he came to the Dodgers. And so the story really begins with Sandy and his elbow, but the main inflection point is certainly when Tommy John injured the inner ligament of his elbow, something called the UCL, and it stabilizes the elbow when the pitcher has his arm all the way back ready to throw the ball. And so that small little ligament, if torn, you end up with an unstable elbow. And so what Dr. Frank Jobe did is he pioneered the first surgery to reconstruct that inner ligament using a tendon from the wrist of Tommy John. And Tommy John successfully came back. Almost half of his career occurred after the surgery. So it was a successful surgery, and it certainly did its job. The Cobra effect of this story is the fact that the largest population undergoing the surgery today is 15 to 19-year-olds. And some surveys that have been done of high school athletes and coaches, as well as even members of the Major League Baseball media, nearly 50% of those surveyed did not know you needed an injury for this surgery, and many saw it as a performance enhancement. And so we have this idea that this is almost a rite of passage. It's a crutch to fall back on, and perhaps it's even better to have this surgery because you might come out stronger. And the vast majority of those beliefs are myths and have not been proven. And so we have a well-intentioned idea that served its purpose. It got Tommy John back. It's rather successful in getting about 80-85% of professional pitchers back. But we have this epidemic simply because we have the surgery and there's a misinformation surrounding its use and benefits.
Right, which is a really scary thing to think about, young pitchers undergoing this surgery either for no good reason or with intentions that that just aren't borne out by the facts or by the research. In this chapter, by the way, one of the things you talk about in terms of what would be a far more sensible and scientifically based rationale for guarding the pitching arms of young athletes would be to adhere more closely, more faithfully to something as simple as the pitch count. Explain to our listeners what we're talking about with the pitch count and why there is, at least in some circles, a bit of resistance to this simple solution.
Yeah, there are several things that have been shown to reduce elbow injuries. Pitch counts are one of them. Not playing baseball year-round is another, which we certainly can talk about, how sports have changed now where young athletes are playing the same sport year-round, and that's not how traditionally these sports have been played. But the pitch count idea came about, started in Little League and has progressed through high school, and even now we're keeping track of pitches in the professional leagues. And it's the idea that based on how many pitches you've thrown, what your age is, there's a maximum number of pitches and also a minimum number of days of rest between pitching games. And the resistance comes about because, number one, no one is who's against it is maybe that familiar with the research. But even if they are, when you have large schools, especially in the high school system, and they're competing against smaller schools, the larger schools have deeper rosters. They have deeper benches, so they have more pitchers, whereas the smaller schools may not have the depth to abide by these pitch counts. And secondly, because there is a set number, some of the opponents don't really understand how you can define 10 pitches, for instance, being the limit between a young adolescent and a college player, or a college player and a professional player. So the what appears to them to be a small number of pitches seems to be a sticking point for many folks. The truth is, though, when we're doing the pitch counts, we're not even keeping track of the warm-up pitches, the pitches between innings. So the future of this research is certainly trying to better quantify what's going on besides just what's on the mound during the game, but also what's happening during warm-ups and between innings. And it's not only the pitchers who are at risk, but catchers as well. So now in Little League, for instance, you can't play pitcher and catcher at the same time, because every time the pitcher throws the ball, the catcher throws the ball back. And so the catchers are also people who suffer from this injury, as well as outfielders, infielders as well. But really the next wave is going to be looking at the catcher as well.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Jonathan Gelber. We're talking about his book, Tiger Woods' Back and Tommy John's Elbow, Injuries and Tragedies That Transformed Careers, Sports, and Society. One of the most intriguing chapters, as far as I'm concerned, is the chapter in which you explore the conversation that has sprung up in recent years around abuse of steroids. And your chapter highlights the sad story of a football player whose name, frankly, I had all but forgotten until I read your book, one Lyle Alzado, who was a real animal out on the field, a very, very aggressive and skilled player for the L.A. Raiders primarily. And his is a sad story that ultimately ends with his death at the age of 43. About halfway through this chapter, you pose kind of the central question: what can we do with the parable of Lyle Alzado? So first of all, sketch what that parable is, in effect, and why it is a story that, in a sense, we have to be careful to understand with great care.
Yeah, so Lyle is an interesting character, perhaps one of the most interesting characters in the book. And Lyle grew up in an abusive household, and he saw from a very early age that he was to be a protector. So he would protect his siblings, he even protected his mother from his abusive father, but he also had this gladiator instinct, this fighting instinct in him. So it was a rage that grew inside him. And so Lyle found this outlet in football. He wanted to be a boxer like his father. In fact, he even did a few rounds against Muhammad Ali in a exhibition match. But he found his outlet in football. And he, if you were to describe him, he looks like a barbarian. He was the epitome of a barbarian out on the field. In fact, there's a Lyle Alzado rule where you can't take off your helmet and use it to attack your opponent, all because of Lyle Alzado. And so we have a man who grew up in this abusive household who had a rage inside him, but he also abused anabolic steroids. And the conversation came about because Lyle was using steroids. He was getting bigger and stronger, but the entire time he was denying that he ever used anabolic steroids. And it was a big scene of anabolic steroids, especially in Los Angeles, where he ended up moving to a Gold's Gym. And so when he was diagnosed with a brain lymphoma, he came out, penned an article for Sports Illustrated saying how sorry he was. He went on a show, an interview with Maria Shriver, admitted to his steroid use, and he became this gaunt figure dressed in a bandana, a shadow of his former self. And he said that his brain lymphoma came from the anabolic steroid use, which is highly unlikely. He was using some human growth hormone, and maybe there was a connection there, but the lymphoma of the brain was highly unlikely. And so what happened was we had a lot of people who were ready to talk about steroids, And the media was talking about steroids, but we were focusing on the wrong thing. We were focusing on brain lymphoma and roid rage especially. And we knew from an early age that Lyle had this rage inside him. So the steroids just made it more overt. And so it's hard to separate Lyle, the person, from Lyle and the steroid user. And we focused on things like roid rage when that is not as common as things like heart disease, so cardiovascular disease and depression. These are real, more common problems. So while it was good that we focused on steroids, because we focused on the lymphoma and we focused on the roid rage, we really lost the ear of the young athlete and the bodybuilder and anybody else who might be abusing anabolic steroids. So it really drove the conversation underground, and we haven't had a good conversation since that time.
And so I think part of what you're saying is that the conversations that we have had have, in a sense, been hijacked by the wrong topics or by the wrong focus. And that is a wasted opportunity, and also, in a sense, kind of dangerous, because the most significant dangers and risks that we should be talking about, we have not been talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of these stories involve wasted opportunities. So Lyle and the steroid conversation was one. And believe it or not, Magic Johnson and his HIV diagnosis, there is an element of missed conversation there, and that's the effect on African-American females and his wife, Cookie Johnson. Now, Cookie and Magic have done a tremendous amount of bringing awareness to HIV, and Magic's own struggle helped to normalize social and physical interaction of those with HIV. But it's interesting because when Magic made his announcement, there were increased testing rates across the country of all demographic groups. But the group that had the most persistent effect was actually the white heterosexual male under age 40 who had the least likelihood of having HIV. Whereas today, the highest group that's disproportionately affected by HIV is the African-American female. And so while Magic had an effect across the board, his greatest effect was the white male under the age of 40 who was heterosexual, and that's not the group we needed to reach. It was actually the African-American females that we still need to reach today. And that's where focusing on Cookie Johnson may have had a better effect in terms of finding the right population to get the message to.
Let's talk for a moment about the other famous athlete named in your book's title, and arguably Tiger Woods is among the most famous athletes who ever lived, and yet also, of course, has a career that has been marked with some really bewildering controversy. And the story of Tiger Woods, of course, is sometimes dominated by some of those rather lurid headlines of his kind of personal downfall with his arrest a few years ago and bringing it to light some very unseemly aspects of his personal life. But really what is far more important for us to examine is what Tiger Woods experienced with some of his back trouble and some of the unintended consequences of the misery that he experienced through all of that. Explain, first of all, what we know about the nature of the injury itself and the kind of dark road that ultimately led him down.
Yeah, so Tiger's back was a different injury for him than previous injuries he had powered through. So with his knee, the exception of having ACL surgery, his Achilles tendon, his injuries previously were ones that he could sort of grimace, push through the pain, get the ball down the fairway, and deal with the pain afterwards. The problem with the back was it became such a point that he couldn't even start his swing. So it wasn't one where he could just power through. And so he had several surgeries to remove the disc between the bones of the spine, but eventually he ran out of disc to remove, and so he had to have a fusion. So when you have a fusion, you lose some rotation, and at his level, every degree of rotation matters. And you also start to wear away the joints that are now mobile above and below the fusion. So with the back, it's certainly going to affect his career long term. You know, he's not going to be able to play as many tournaments in a year as he used to. We've seen that he can win. I mean, he won the Masters. That was a great great come from, you know, unexpected victory. But he's not going to be able to play as many tournaments. He's going to have to be more choosy in which ones he competes in. So that's the physical level. But the more societal story is his abuse of pain medicine and his addiction. And he is not the only professional athlete addicted to pain medicine, or who was. Brett Favre had talked about this many years ago as well in the NFL. In fact, studies by some folks who basically went through the NFL Players Association directory and just called players up and surveyed them found a significant number were addicted to pain medicine, and it had started during their football career. So that's a story that we haven't talked about. And not only is the story of pain medicine addiction one that we need to discuss, but the combination of pain medicine and benzodiazepines, which is what was found in Tiger system when he was found on the side of the road in Jupiter, Florida by the police. And it's that combination of benzodiazepines like Xanax and pain medicine, which is one that affects the country in general as well. We are having discussions about the opioid crisis, but equally as important is this cross-prescription of benzodiazepines and the opioids. And that's something that Tiger felt firsthand, and that's another conversation that we as a society need to have. And Tiger's story could have been one that would have highlighted this for the rest of the country. But unfortunately, we didn't really focus on that with Tiger Woods.
We focused on some of these other matters of how he was living his life, and those headlines grabbed far too much of the attention. I think your book, this chapter of your book, raises a very central point, and that is the role that that a given athlete's doctor or team of doctors plays in a sense assisting them in these moments of crisis in their lives and careers. And you write that the idea of getting an athlete through a game or through a tournament or playoffs is actually part of the art, in quotes, the art of treating the high-level athlete. That is part of what such a physician is charged with, is getting that player out on the field, out on the course, out on the ball diamond. And sometimes it seems like one way or another, no matter what the risks might be, just so they can manage to play that crucial tournament or that crucial game. I suspect that that's probably one of the toughest parts of the game, and it is out of that that many physicians face probably some of the most difficult choices of their careers.
Yeah, the treatment of an athlete in season versus out of season really is an art, because a lot of the solutions we have, especially me as an orthopedic surgeon, are surgeries. And if you do a surgery on some athletes, that may end their career. So you may not be able to do that surgery in season, and yet they have an upcoming tournament. If it's LeBron James, for instance, it might be the NBA Finals. But even at the adolescent level, you know, so many young athletes and their families are focused on a big game coming up. And so they want them to experience the joy of participating in that big game. Now, when it comes to the different ages, though, you know, when you're getting paid millions of dollars to fight through the pain as a professional athlete versus you have pain as a young athlete, that's where we have to draw the line as docs. Is, you know, you want to protect the young athlete especially. You want to protect the elite athlete as well, but their ability or their long-term benefit of pushing through the pain could certainly be different and is different than the young athlete. So there is certainly an art to that. And, you know, it's hard. Sometimes you do have to protect the athlete from themselves as well, because all they know is driving and pushing through pain. And sometimes you have to help them to take a step back and look at the long-term picture. So there really is an art to that. And I think that has changed over the years, especially in the NFL. We have teams of trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, nutritionists, orthopedic surgeons, neurologists, primary care docs. I mean, there are great teams around these athletes. Where we don't have that right now is actually the world of mixed martial arts. That's a fast-growing sport, but the athletes don't have an off-season, so it's very difficult to treat them like you would an NFL player, and they don't have the teams around them as well. So that's a sport where we really need to begin our focus on helping to protect the athlete and give them the treatment they deserve as elite athletes.
Finally, I want you to say a quick word about one of the points made in your chapter about the world of boxing, and in particular the very sad story of Duk Kung Kim, who died in the ring in a very high-profile match with Ray Mancini, and which led to certain changes being made. But you talk about how the sport of boxing itself and the way it's sort of organized makes meaningful change very, very difficult. Just say a quick word about why this is a complicated landscape and a complicated problem.
Yeah, and that certainly dovetails off of mixed martial arts, because both of those sports, they are interrelated. And it's the fact that we don't have a national governing body, or we don't have one central body. Baseball has Major League Baseball, the National Football League, the NFL, National Basketball Association, NBA are all groups that are a central body. With MMA and boxing, you have state commissions. So the rules are governing the sport by each state. And then in boxing, especially, you have multiple federations. It's almost an alphabet soup of federations. IBF, WBA, WBC, and each one has a champion. And so you have this quagmire of organizations where there's just so many competing interests that it's very difficult to have discussions and to pass athlete safety measures. We have docs across the nation on athletic commissions, so there's a voice there, but then it becomes a problem when athletes change states. We don't have a centralized medical record system, for instance. So an athlete that suffers an injury in California may move to Florida, and we don't know about that. And especially if they're a low-level fighter, the so-called journeyman or opponent, whose job it is to go from state to state and fight the younger, stronger boxer or mixed martial artist. Those are the athletes that are highest at risk for us not following their health records adequately. And in fact, this is a very poignant story in the media now, because we just had a death, Patrick Day, a boxer who died in a match in Chicago just last week. And he died at the end of the 10th round. And some of the research that's discussed in the book shows that even after the rule changes, where Duk Kung Kim died and we lowered the rounds from 15 to 12, we still have the deadliest rounds being 3rd and 10th, and that's the round that Patrick Day died after, was the 10th round. So these are still very important data points and very important discussions that we need to have.
And, of course, the book overall is a reminder that we need to be careful about what we pay attention to, and that we don't lose the biggest messages behind sometimes the headlines that capture our attention to an unwarranted extent. It's a fascinating book. Again, it's titled Tiger Woods' Back and Tommy John's Elbow, Injuries and Tragedies That Transformed Careers, Sports, and Society. The author, Dr. Jonathan Gelber. Dr. Gelber, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The book came out last week, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the Walmart website, and as well as your local book dealer. So I encourage even non-sports fans to check it out, because as you mentioned, each story delves beyond sports into other stories that we can all learn as a society.
Absolutely. A lot of important lessons here. Thank you again.
Thank you. Have a great day.
This weekend, on the podcast version of The Morning Show, two interviews out of the archives, one of them with the author of a very interesting novel based on the life of Marie Antoinette, a book called Abundance. On Sunday, I'll be rebroadcasting an interview recorded way back in 2010 with Temple Grandin. And on this particular occasion, I talked with Temple Grandin about her book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Possible Lives for Our Pets. On Monday's program, I'm very excited to share with you an interview I'll be recording later this morning with Jeffrey Wise, the new superintendent for the Kenosha Unified School District. Next week's morning show lineup also includes a conversation with Molly Fletcher, a force of nature in the world of professional sports, as one of the first female agents in professional sports. Molly Fletcher is coming to speak at Carthage College in early November. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the morning show archived on our website, WGTD.org. Sunshine today, high of 59 degrees, overnight a low of 36. Sunny tomorrow again and a high of 61. Similar forecast on Sunday. This is WGTD.